Not only does Flag Hill Winery and Distillery make an outstanding brandy called Josiah Bartlett, but it also happens to be the oldest distillery in New Hampshire. We're going to be hearing about the process from apple to the final glass with owner and master distiller Brian Ferguson and his wingman David Breslin in this here episode 335 of Cider Chat. Hey, 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 my name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. What I love about this week's episode is that Brian Ferguson, who is the master distiller at Flag Hill Winery and Distillery, is so good at explaining a very technical process in super simple language that really anyone can follow. And there's something for everyone here. You don't have to be a distiller to enjoy how he talks about really working with that pre-fermentation of cider to get it to the point where, boy, they're good to go for distillation and then the actual aging process afterwards. And we're going to be joined both by Brian and the company's mega wingman, and that is David Breslin. Really wonderful chat. I had an amazing sit down and went through a wonderful tasting with them. A lot of their products, besides the apple brandy, also have the base of apple. And there is a certain kind of house smoothness that I have found in all of Flag Hill's products. And the reason why it's so smooth is because apples are used as the base for many of their distilled products. So that means they take the apples, they ferment it into cider, and then it's distilled. And then through that distillation, they are creating different products. So of course, we have the Josiah Bartlett Apple Brandy. And then there's also the Carner Blue Gin, which just made my jaw drop because I'm a big spirit fan and I really love gin. I really love rum. In this case, they make both. And my goodness, Brian Ferguson was so kind to give me samples of both of those to take home. Yowza. The gin is called Carner Blue, named after the state butterfly. The bottle alone is just a centerpiece because as you turn it, you see the blue of this butterfly on the front. And as you turn it all the way on the back, you'll see the outline of the other side of the butterfly. I actually took a video of it because I was just so wowed by the bottle. And then also they have the General John Stark Vodka, also with a base of apple. Just a lovely experience. We went through a whole series of tastings here. The nice thing about this particular episode is that it's pretty succinct because once Brian goes and he starts talking, you don't want to stop because he's so good at telling you the process and really simplifying it. So stay tuned for that. But first, a wee bit of news from out and about in Ciderville. In last week's episode, we heard part two with Laird's & Company. And the week before, it was part one, which was the history of Laird's & Company, the oldest distillery in America, going back 324 years. And then in last week's episode, we took a walkabout in the barrel aging warehouse. It just was a phenomenal recording to take part in. I really hope you could check that out. And then in this week's episode, we're talking again about distilling apple brandy. So you might be thinking, wow, this is Cider Chat. Like, you know, is that cider? Well, in order to make brandy, apple brandy, you need to make cider first. And I know there's a lot of makers now working with local distilleries where they're transforming their cider into brandy and then adding on what I would call a value-added product to their compilation of products that they offer. I think this is marvelous. I think this is the way to go because, in truth, that's what is being done in many regions in the world that have been cider-making regions for quite a long time, continuously making cider throughout. And they are not only offering cider, but these value-added products such as brandy, apple brandy, or Calvados, as we know it in France, or Pommeau, which is a blend of fresh pressed apple juice with Calvados. So I think the writing's on the wall. And this is really my hope to nudge people to like really start understanding this, because there is a bit of a misconception out there thinking, oh yeah, you know, you can make brandy out of cider that you don't want to drink. But that's not true at all. In fact, if you listen to this episode or even last week's episode with Lisa Laird Dunn, you're going to hear that from the start point to the end point. So the start point being when they start fermenting the cider, you know, they press the juice, they have juice, they start fermenting it. I'm going to even go over to France. In France, at Domaine DuPont, Etienne DuPont told me 3 days after that cider starts fermenting, they go to the distillation room and start distilling that. And for Allaire's, it's like within the 2 week period, maybe less. And the same thing for Flag Hill Winery and Distillery. They're right in primary fermentation, and there's a good reason why. And you're going to be hearing about that on this chat with Brian on this here episode. I think the writing is on the wall, and we're going to be seeing more of this. And I hope so, because, you know, it's really cool to go to Cider Expo, not only to have cider, but to have Poiret, Calvados, and Pommeau all at the same table for each maker. That just, you know, there's no comparison like that in the world yet. I always like to add yet when I'm talking about cider, because that's the way it rolls. So, yeah, check out those last episodes. And the other piece about that is that both Laird's & Company and Flag Hill Winery and Distillery, their apple brandies are going to be featured at the upcoming Calvados and American Apple Brandy Tasting as part of Cider Days 2.0 kickoff event on Friday night, November 4th. Tickets are now on sale for all the Cider Days 2.0 ticketed events. So that's Friday the 4th and the 5th. And there will be an upcoming episode called Going to Cider Days, but I don't want you to wait for that. That's going to be rolling out in October, and tickets are now selling for these events. And I'd be super bummed if people contact me after and say, can I get a ticket? Because there is really only a set amount that we could do for each of them. We don't want to have like a huge conference kind of dinner on Saturday night, because we're bringing back the cider dinner with 6 women producers. And that's going to be intimate and gourmand. I actually was just with the caterer yesterday having lunch and talking about the menu. And I just want to tell you, oh, yo, a 5-course gluten-free dinner paired with the Lisa cocktail, and then 5 different ciders, and then the dessert infused with Laird's apple brandy. Mouthwatering, absolutely mouthwatering. And not only are you going to have the producers who are there, the women producers, but guess who's going to be like in the audience? Other really cool cider makers, commercial cider makers, and super cool cider fans. Wow. I'm just over the moon. There's also the cider pop-up happening on Saturday. We're going to have Morris dancers in downtown Greenfield. It's going to be a super cool event. So don't wait. Check it out. Google Cider Days 2.0, or you could just go to ciderchat.com. You'll see a link right there, Cider Days 2.0. It'll bring you to all the tickets, because that's where we're going to be rolling it out this year. Cider Chat is sponsoring Cider Days 2.0, rebooting a beloved event that's been around since 1994, and I really hope that you could join me, Laird's & Company, Flag Hill Winery and Distillery, all the Calvados makers from France, and, well, not all the makers are coming over from France, but not this year, maybe next year, but it's going to be a really cool time. Yeah, check it out. I have so much to say about it, but we're going to move on with this episode. I'll be right back. Next week's episode is going to be with Fermentis, and Fermentis provides yeast to fermenters. So whether you are an amateur cider maker like myself, or a commercial cider maker, a winemaker, a beer maker, somebody who distills, this is a good episode to listen to. And we went through all the cider yeasts that they currently have at Fermentis and talked about the different strains, the Saccharomyces, and how that impacts the cider and what to be looking for. So it's super, super cool. And one of the things you should know about is that coming up on September 29th, there's going to be an online Q&A session with Fermentis. So next week, you could kind of get a nice dose. And if you want to keep on preparing for this season's harvest and cider making, you might want to go to Fermentis.com and sign up for that Q&A sooner than later, just while it's on your mind, right? Oh, you know, it happens. You hear something on the podcast, and it's like, well, what did they say? So there's a Q&A on September 29th with Fermentis. And one of the things that I really like about Fermentis is that they're really kind people. I mean, that you might say, oh, I thought she was going to say something about the yeast, but no, they're really kind people. They're very helpful. And the fact that they are supporting an indie podcaster like myself just tells you a lot right there. In fact, I want to announce now that they're supporting Cider Days 2.0, and they're going to send a little bit of swag for the folks who are going to be at the cider dinner. So that's exciting. I won't say what it is, but you might be able to guess right off the top of the head, because Fermentis has the right yeast for your favorite cider. Crisp, sweet, or fruity. Explore all their sap cider ranges. You just go to Fermentis.com. And while there, sign up for their Q&A session on September 29th at Fermentis.com.
Walking through the orchards.
I did have a walkabout at Flag Hill Winery and Distillery, and I want to tell you, it has a total wow factor. And it should, because it's a huge venue event for things like weddings and those real special occasions. This is a site that you want to be looking at if you're up in that area or coming in from anywhere in the world. I mean, they could handle it, and you're going to be really happy with the products that they're going to be serving. Brian and David took me for a walkabout, and we went down into the barrel room. So make sure to check out on Instagram this week some of the clips from that, or at the Cider Chat Facebook page. You'll be able to see little clips that I took of that walkabout. The barrel room had about 500 barrels of their precious apple brandy in. So cool. Really, really a nice time. And then we walked through the kitchen. We took a little shortcut getting over to a look at the still, and it tells you a lot about an owner who has no problem walking you through their kitchen any time of day. And the folks, it was really clean. It felt really great. We cruised through there, looked at the still. It's kind of like running 24/7 there, because they have a lot of product that they're rolling out. The rum, so cool. Their little gift shop, really, really neat. And of course, this conversation. So check it out, Ciderville. Grab that glass and join this chat with Brian Ferguson and David Breslin at Flag Hill Winery and Distillery in Lee, New Hampshire.
Flag Hill started, I believe 94 was the official date, but we had started planting grapes in the early 90s. I want to say 1990. It used to be a dairy farm. The previous owner of the farm had decided that, he'd come back from the military and decided that they really loved wine and really wanted to do show what could be done here in the Northeast. And he did a lot of the legwork, really, in the area. Him and another gentleman. So his name is Frank Reinhold, and there's another gentleman named Peter Oldack. They're kind of like the grandfathers of the New Hampshire wine industry, the current New Hampshire wine industry, which is kind of, without going too deep, it's kind of the second iteration of a wine industry that's occurred here. There was one that happened in the 60s or 70s, and it was actually quite a boom. There was a lot of people that planted a lot of acreage. And it just was the wrong varietals, and they made poor decisions in terms of quality in their winemaking, I guess. This is what I've been told. I obviously wasn't alive for it. But that completely went defunct, and there was nobody really making wine for a long time. And so the second generation of the New Hampshire wine industry is really kind of founded by Frank Reinhold and Peter Oldack. They did a lot of legwork on what could be grown here, what would do well. Then, we really kind of, for the first 10 years or so, kind of figured some of those things out. In 2004, we started our distillery. We were the first in New Hampshire. We had to make a lot of law changes to make spirits here in New Hampshire.
Was that the first distillery post-prohibition?
In New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire, right.
Correct.
There's a lot of
right before
stills,
completely.
Time, yeah.
Yeah, completely. So,
which is notable. That's notable that you're the first distillery here.
Since Prohibition. Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Since kind of the advent of like the three-tier system and that whole situation. At least in modern history, we were the first. And kind of focused right in the early days on, which is fitting for this discussion, on apple products, because that's what grows really well here in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. A lot of times distilleries, they really look for what is the feedstock, the input product that they have in the area has, I hate to say it this way, but what is cheap sugar? Where mm-hmm. is the cheap sugar?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's traditionally how it's always been done. And people come up with different ways to do this, but basically here in New Hampshire, the idea was to use drops from an apple farm out of Concord, New Hampshire, and make that they didn't have a lot of use for, and to make cider from that, and then to make vodka and brandy, and we make our sugar maple liqueur, which I actually didn't even think to bring out here, sugar maple liqueur, and our gin. All that comes from apple, a base of apple cider.
That's fantastic.
So it's a really cool start there. And then, you know, if we fast forward a little bit, my wife and I bought the farm in 2015. I'd actually been working here for Frank for a couple of years. I'd moved here from Grand Cayman. I didn't grow up in Grand Cayman. I was working there for a little while. I was the head of sales for Cayman Spirits Company. And I moved here to run the distillery operation. And he had put an offer on the table to make it worth me staying here to buy the facility and keep running it. And then after I'd bought bought Flag Hill and the farm, we decided to kind of retool. We weren't happy with where the wines were going. So what we did was we retooled the winery entirely. We've made major investments in our winery, and focused on precision agriculture for the grapes that we're growing, and precision winemaking in the actual cellar, to get really good at making aromatic, off dry and semi sweet white varietal wines, because that's what we do really well here in the Northeast. And there's a reason for this, a physical and a chemical reason for this. So first off, if we go to our grapes are really great, because the genetics that allow them to survive in the cold climates that we have here, not in the summer, but over the winter, that's the limiting factor,
right?
Is our cold winters. So the genetics that allow them to do that are interesting because they also lead to higher acidity in the fruit, higher acid, and more of these precursor aromatic compounds in the grape skins that can then be transformed into flavors and aromas and things that smell and taste like stuff, mm-hmm. right? Stuff that's mm-hmm. exciting. And then, so step one, we've got the chemistry in the fruit to do this style, but then it just so happens to align with step two, which is when we harvest our fruit here in New England. Mm. We have these beautiful cold mornings. It's nothing. If anyone is listening to this and they're from New England, you know, it's nothing in September for it to be 85 degrees in the middle of the day in early September. And then overnight it drops to 40. Well, those 80 degree days are great because we're ripening fruit. We're putting sugar in fruit. We're moving things along. And then we get these nice crisp cold snaps overnight. And that is the perfect time to harvest the fruit. We harvest mechanically. We do it early in the morning. We usually start just before daybreak, was the coldest part of the morning. And we stop shortly after sunrise. And what mm-hmm. that does specifically is we're picking fruit at a very cold temperature. And it's just simple physics. The less heat energy that's in that molecule, the slower that molecule is moving, the less chance of there being a chemical reaction, specifically an oxidation chemical reaction, mm-hmm. where we bind oxygen and either destroy a compound that we wanted, or even worse than that, in the moving of the fruit off gas, one of those chemical compounds that smells and tastes like something, one of those mm-hmm. flavor compounds, because mm-hmm. once it's gone, it is gone forever. We can't get it back.
Right.
So Perfect. The colder we can harvest right. that fruit, the higher the probability is statistically that we will keep and maintain those flavors. You have to, if you kind of like reverse engineer the problem, you say, okay, so we have all these really beautiful aromatic properties. How do we keep them? So then you figure out what destroys them. And then you engineer away from those things. You solve for those problems. So the basically there's kind of three things that could destroy these really delicate aromatic properties. One is them escaping and being lost forever. Two is an oxidation, a chemical oxidation reaction, or redox. And then the third thing would be something that overshadows them that is negative. So that would be microbial in nature, typically. That creates a compound that is, like, maybe it's, you know, what ultimately results in dimethyl disulfide or some compound that is really quite negative. So the first piece, temperature, we have, because we're here in New Hampshire, right? So we can harvest cold. That helps us right off the get-go. So our fruit target comes through the door at less than 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Depending on the varietal, some of them as low as 45 degrees Fahrenheit. So Deschonac, our target goal, because we're making a rosé with it, and it's a very dark fruit. It's a very long story that I won't get into. But basically, to keep the pigment out of the wine as much as possible, we have to harvest at basically less than 45 degrees Fahrenheit. And then that keeps all the aromatics, and it makes a really beautiful rosé, like a really, really beautiful rosé. Much more intense aromatically than what a lot of rosés are. That's really pretty. So we bring fruit into the winery, and then it's cold while we press it very rapidly. So we are done pressing the fruit the day it comes through the door. And we've kept it cold. Now we're into a tank where we chill it to about 34 degrees Fahrenheit. And that allows us to do a process called protein stabilization. We're cold settling. We're removing proteins out of the solution. And this is going to make for a cleaner fermentation. And we're going to be able to get a lot of those really pretty aromatic properties out. And then we do a nice, really slow, controlled cold fermentation, depending on the fruit. Some are as low as 54, 55 degrees. Some are as high as 60 degrees. And then we are arresting our fermentations early. This is, though a well-known about technique, most people don't understand how rare this is for wineries to do, because it's actually quite challenging to arrest the fermentation early. So our goal is not to make intensely... we don't want to make sweet wines. We're not trying to make, oftentimes not trying to make a dry wine. There's a balance. With some of this stuff, we want to be a little bit sweeter, a little bit drier. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, the goal is to balance the acidity with the sugar so that the two things are very approachable together, right? So that, like, they're together in harmony. So what we're trying to do here is hit a target that is actually a month and a half away. So the end goal, we actually have a titratable acidity change between the moment that we arrest the fermentation and the moment we put in a bottle. There's typically upwards of 2 grams per liter change in the total acidity in the solution. So we're really kind of trying to aim at a moving target in the future, and this is where part of the precision comes in, is in this arresting the fermentation and trapping those natural fruit sugars. We do this with cold temperatures, and then we put it through a cross flow filter, which pulls all the yeast out of the solution so that we have no more fermentation. And I know there's kind of like a debate about some people just don't like the cleanliness of it, in filtration in general, right, is a debated topic in the wine industry of how much filtration is too much filtration.
Spirits as well,
yeah, completely. Typically from two different angles, but one, spirits are oftentimes, the argument around filtration is typically focused on some of the oils and some of the and then carbon, obviously carbon. And then in wine, it's more focused on like how many micron are we going down to, and how much does this change? Like, a lot of people will take red wines and they will not sterile filter red wines. My opinion of this, having done trials of doing filtration down to sterility and then filtrations not to to sterility, on the same batch of wine, bottled in different days as tests, is that there is a change for sure in the wine for the first week. And then once we've recovered from whatever that, and I could not explain to you what's happening there. I don't, like, there's some theory on this and what's happening. And I couldn't tell you that I have a great answer on exactly why this occurs, but there's definitely a change when we sterile filter red wines at first. For the first week or two. Okay. Sometimes 2 weeks. Yeah. But then those wines are, you cannot tell them apart. They 2 or 3 weeks down the road. You cannot tell them apart. And we actually do, our apple wine was made using a lot of these techniques that I'm going to talk about, that I'm talking about right now. By arresting the fermentation early, we've done another thing, which is we've trapped a little bit of carbon dioxide in the solution. And this is very valuable. I didn't talk about this at all early on, but those flip, I said the piece about oxidation occurring is one of the things that we're trying to engineer away from.
Right.
What I didn't talk about was our gas management in our tanks. Like our fruit, when it comes through the door, from the moment it comes through the door, will not see oxygen again. There's some oxygen in the, like, latent in the fruit, and that's what's going to be used to grow the yeast. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that's used up, we'll enter that anaerobic environment. We'll start alcoholic fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
But we are basically under a gaseous blanket of CO2 with our fruit from the time it comes through the door until basically
it's in a glass.
And so that leads to the next piece of the precision winemaking, which we've invested in a lot of these tools, right? All the tanks that have insulation and jackets and control and the cross flow filter that allows us to make sure that we're arresting fermentations and then gas management systems that allow us to manage gas and CO2. Mm-hmm. So we'll actually transfer wines from tank to tank. And bubble CO2 through them as we're moving them to dislodge any O2 molecules that might be in the solution. So this is early in the process, not
love
later
it,
in the process. This
it.
Is early in the process. And then what we do is when we go into a bottle, just recently we did this, we invested in a system that allows us into a monoblock bottler, which allows us to manage oxygen down to 0.005 nanomoles per deciliter, which our old system used to allow us to manage oxygen to 5 nanomoles per deciliter.
Mm-hmm.
So significantly different.
Yeah, that's huge.
So, and then we go into a Stelvin package with a Saranac liner so that anyone who understands anything about what I just said is basically the best possible packaging solution to... It's a screw top. It's what looks like a screw top.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very... very specifically engineered screw top that allows us to now allow almost zero oxygen transfer into the bottle, and the Saranac liner actually pulls O2 out of the whatever could be in there.
Mm-hmm.
Actually helps scavenge some of the O2 molecules. So we've really, like, from basically start to the very finish of the winemaking procedure, we have kind of looked at every place and said, how do we handle it the least amount of times possible? Which, again, it's every time we handle is a chance that we're going to off gas some of those aromatic properties or introduce a bacteria or something that might be a problem. We're fermenting cold, trapping all those natural aromatic properties in the solution. We harvested cold. We've kept O2 away from the wine the whole time and even into the package. So it's really quite precise winemaking from the time we start until the time we end. And it's resulted in much better wines. We were really excited this year at Finger Lakes International Wine Competition, which for us is kind of the big show. There's other international wine competitions, but I personally don't believe there are other international wine competitions that focus on white wines like this one does. There isn't as much competition. This is kind of like, in my opinion, one of the most competitive places to see these aromatic white varietal wines, because you get some wines from Germany, you get some wines from the Finger Lakes, you know, people who are really good at this style of winemaking. And our 21 Vignol vintage that was harvested here at Flag Hill won a double gold, which we were very, very excited about.
Fantastic.
It was really
congratulations.
Cool.
Really, yeah. Excited. They do know their wine out in the Finger Lakes.
Yes.
and you know, people they like the dry style in the Finger Lakes
completely.
Too. So that's really meeting your market in the same way what you're working here in New Hampshire. Very cool. And I know listeners will really get into, like, the technical piece, which you really did a nice overview on. That's gonna give people a lot to think about. So you have the winery and you have the distillery. And I'm looking out this, we're in this, what do we call this room here?
This is our dining room.
Dining room,
yeah.
Okay. And I'm looking out, I could see that there's, I don't know if that's corn down there. Almost
there
looks like corn. That's corn, okay.
Yeah,
but
so,
driving up, I saw some vineyards too.
Yeah, so we've got the vineyard here. We've got roughly about 15 acres under vine, and we've got another 5 acres or so that's going to go in. And then the other part of the farm, it's a 110-acre farm. The other part of the farm that is really exciting is... the agriculture that we grow for our whiskey production. So we actually grow all of our grain, with the exception of malt, We don't grow barley to make malt, although I'd love to. We just don't do that yet.
I like that.
So we're going to need more land. We don't have enough land yet.
Malting facility.
And a malting facility.
I'll be out there.
It's okay. You can do it, David. You can do it.
I'm just waiting for Brian to send me out.
David has been pretty much every part of this business. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the distilling here. Because we're going to be serving your Josiah Bartlett brandy, the apple brandy, at the Calvados and American Apple Brandy Tasting coming up in November.
We're so excited for that. That's super cool.
I'm so stoked. Really stoked in what you're doing here. And you have a number of different products that you're working with apples, too, in the distillery. Let's talk about the still to begin with. The setup there and what you have.
We have a Carl still that was formerly known as Christian Carl, and it is a hybrid still. So we were actually one of the first for Carl in the U.S. When they built our still. I was actually just talking to Nick Haas, who was their lead liaison in America. I was just talking to him the other day, I didn't know this, but we were one of their first hybrid stills that they had built for the kind of like new burgeoning craft spirits industry in America. So one of the things that used to be challenging, it's very commonplace today, but none of the still designs really did lots of products. They were all built to do a product or a couple types of products. And we needed to be able to do everything, you know, I hate to say the word dirty. That's how I say it, dirty bourbon. Like, what I mean by that is, not that it's actually physically dirty, but I like quite a lot of extra material in the spirit, in terms of how we distill it. So, and I'll kind of define what that is in just a second. So everything from that, which is basically a double pot distillation method. So we're keeping a lot of stuff other than just the ethanol. And then all the way up to vodka. And we wanted to be able to do everything in between and really on one platform. So our still has the ability to run as a pot still, has the ability with some plumbing change some quick connect plumbing change to run through a short column with four trays and a deflamator. And it has the ability to run through a tall column with a deflamator. And the tall column allows us to make vodka. The tall column, I believe, is 14 trays. We've got to run it a couple times before that, before we go through the tall column, to be able to get to 190 proof. But it does allow us to make a 190 proof spirit. So we were able to do pretty much everything. When I said earlier that, you know, the kind of dirty part of bourbon, it's not that it's dirty. It's that I think about things as having more stuff other than ethanol and less stuff, predominantly just ethanol. So if we're making vodka is 90% alcohol by volume. I'm sorry, 95% alcohol by volume, by law of man and by law of nature. In this part of the world, ethanol can't be more than like 95.6% alcohol by volume. So there's really about a 0.6% gap between the law of man and the law of nature of what can exist in terms of vodka. So it's mainly because once you get to 95.6, water and ethanol form an azeotrope, and they're very difficult to separate, very, very difficult to separate. So what we wind up with is when we're distilling in the higher end of the spirits of the alcohol spectrum, we're having less flavor in the spirit. And when we distill in the lower end of the alcohol spectrum, we have more flavor. Some of that flavor is not good. Which is part of why we make cuts, and there's all these other things that we do to pay attention to in the cleanliness of our fermentation. But certainly when we're making things like our brandy, which we're going to talk about in a second, I'm sure, and our bourbon or our rye, we really want a lot more, a lot more heavy compounds, a lot more of the stuff other than just ethanol and water. That gives us those building blocks to make chemical esters in a barrel.
So let's talk specifically about your apple brandy. And you have to make cider before you make the brandy, right? So you're sourcing, I didn't see any apple trees here, so you're sourcing all your trees from local orchards, is what I could assume.
Correct. Yeah, so we have like, I don't know, maybe six or seven apple trees on the property, but we don't make cider from them. we buy all of our apples from Apple Hill Farm out of Concord, New Hampshire.
Okay.
We've been working with Chuck Souther and his wife Diane for, since the inception of Flight Hill, since mm-hmm. we started distilling.
Mm-hmm.
They have been great partners. They're great people. They're very responsive. Over the years, they've been willing to help us out and move whatever they need to move to make it work for us.
Mm-hmm.
And they've actually, it's interesting, they've actually built an entire business around, and they do many other things. I'm not saying that they're only, the only part of their business is cider, but and for spirits and things like that, but they have built this whole other business model with their orchard that after working with us, where they sell cider to all kinds of craft cideries, or
mm-hmm.
So
they're pressing. They're pressing on site.
Yes.
So they press the apples for you. You get the juice, bring it over here, and you're fermenting on site here. Is that
correct?
Is that correct. Okay.
Correct. And then we do a lot of different things with the cider apples. So we make our vodka. We make the base for our gin. We make the base for our sugar maple liqueur, and we make our brandy. Three of those, other than the brandy, all fall into the same category. We're just looking for high sugar apples. We're looking for yield, predominantly. And then when we make our brandy, I let Chuck know that we are, like, how much brandy cider we're going to need a year. And then when we make brandy, we're specifically focused on high acid apples, high organic acid apples.
Okay.
So we're looking for certain varietals, and I can never remember all the names of the varietals. And I almost wish I had him here because he'd be able to list them off in a heartbeat.
Are they they're high acid, no tannin.
So tannins don't matter for us,
okay,
because we're distilling. So tannins are a great antioxidant, which helps protect from oxidation in the spirit, in the wine, if you're making a wine. They also, short-chain tannic acids kind of have this like astringent quality to them. However, those types of tannins are very good at being polymerized into long-chain structures of tannic acids. And those longer chains have the silky, soft qualities that we are excited about in really high-quality wines. They also give... They give some depth to the wine or the cider. So, but we don't really have to worry about that as much because those things aren't going to transfer through the distillate.
Mm-hmm.
What we're worried about is certain types of organic acids that are going to form chemical esters that will mm-hmm. that, and these things can come across the still,
mm-hmm.
and we're worried about. Oils and fats mm-hmm. that we can get some of those things across the still
mm-hmm.
Because those, all of those things are going to lead to not just the how you perceive the aromatics of the spirit, but also the mouthfeel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And if we could just kind of run through that cider coming in here, because so many cider makers are listening right now. You inoculate with a yeast
immediately.
Immediately. So, if you're doing the same process, I imagine, that you're doing with your wines.
Yep.
Right?
So
really keeping the oxygen out. And...
So it comes in cold.
Mm-hmm.
So the oxidation matters a little less here mm-hmm. for us. Now, that's different if we were making that barrel fermented apple wine. It would matter much more there. But
sure.
It matters a little bit less when we're making our ciders. So they come through the door, and we actually heat up the first little bit to get yeast into it. Because it comes in very cold.
Okay.
It's typically coming to us at 40-ish degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, sure.
That way we have no rogue fermentations happening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we get yeast starter going, get warmed up, get our cider warmed up to about 65-ish degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And then we are using, rehydrate with... yeast rehydration nutrient, which I'm a firm believer in, and we for long haul fermentations, and for increasing it, like in maintaining better aromatics. I think yeast rehydration nutrient certainly makes a big difference, in my personal opinion. I know there's kind of, and that does matter. The quality of those do matter.
You're making it. It's your product. You do whatever you want.
So
you stick to it.
the quality of those definitely matters. So certainly using organic nitrogens, and not for the people who are not winemakers that are listening to this, organic is not organic in the sense that you're thinking of it. You're thinking of it in terms of like go to the grocery store and my vegetables say organic on it. It's not like that type of organic. Mm-hmm. There is a couple sources of nitrogen that we typically get in the winery, distillery, brewery business. And organic nitrogens are more work for the yeast. The way I like to think about it is organic nitrogens are a balanced meal with broccoli and greens and maybe a little bit of meat and some starch and the whole package. Mm-hmm. Inorganic would typically be like diammonium phosphate, DAP. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this leads to, just like if you eat fast food, this is fast food for yeast. If you're eating fast food all the time, you're going to get sick. And the same thing happens to yeast. If you give them a diet of fast food, they get sick. Mm-hmm. And when they get sick, they let off a nasty little critter called H2S. And hydrogen sulfide doesn't smell all that well. And doesn't do good things for wine, and certainly doesn't do good things for spirits. So we stick to organic nitrogens, and we follow a pretty strict yeast rehydration procedure. We basically, it's quite simple. We just get fermentation started. Mm-hmm. Feed at onset of alcoholic fermentation, feed at 1/3 sugar depletion, and then it cruises to completion. And then we start distilling almost immediately.
Yeah, immediately. So that's how many day period between juice?
Seven.
7 days or so. Yeah.
Seven or eight. There's certainly arguments for a slower, colder fermentation. Our system and what we do, I want it to be a little bit faster. This is a little different than winemaking. So I want slightly more aggressive fermentations. There is a trade-off. You are trading off some of the aromatics with a little bit faster fermentation. But one of the things that we're creating are some of the building blocks that will turn into esters in the barrel. So there's kind of a trade-off there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're able to capture some of those things. And that's, so if we, you know, if we, we get them distilling, or I'm sorry, we get them fermenting day seven or so. We start distilling. We do a double pot distillation for our brandy. Okay. So the first pass through, we've got some pretty rugged material that you wouldn't want to drink. So the low wines is not super exceptional. I mean, it is to me. I think it's like I can tell that it's very exciting. But if you came in and smelt it, you'd probably go, that seems really gross. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But on that second pass, all that stuff that was originally really gross, a lot of that stuff, we're gonna trim out the nasties, mm-hmm. and keep the good stuff. Mm-hmm. In that second pot distillation, we're keeping, we actually do something a little bit different than what I have noticed in Calvados. Now, I've never been in Calvados, mm-hmm. and distilled with a distiller in Calvados, so mm-hmm. I don't know this to be 100% factual, mm-hmm. but just judging by all the Calvados I've ever drank and what I know about running apple wine through a still to make, so apple wash to make distillate, mm-hmm. What it appears to me happens in the Calvados region is a lot of the apple aromas come across the still early, very early. So you tie a lot of those flavors up with what I would call heads components, specifically ethyl acetate and acetone. So there's a lot of those acetonal aromas, a lot of very like intense solvents that come across. And I'm not necessarily anything publicly disparaging against Calvados, but there is a, in my opinion, a solventy nature to those spirits, because it seems like a lot of the apple aromas come off in the beginning, and they're keeping a lot of those. And along with some of those are things that I necessarily don't want to keep in my distillate.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do is almost the opposite. So where they're distilling, and it seems like, and again, I don't know this for an absolute fact, but it seems like they're keeping a lot of the beginning of the run that I wouldn't want to keep. We're doing almost the opposite. We're going deeper into the run than probably what they're going. And we're keeping a lot of the fats and the oils and the heavy congener products that are going to as they sit in a barrel, develop back into some of those apple flavor and aromas. So it's funny, if you were to smell our new make apple brandy spirit, you probably would not like it. You probably would think that there's no way that's going to become Josiah Bartlett apple brandy. And it's really cool when you put it in the barrel and six years later you pull it out and you go, this is what this is what that was 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And as you see the two things next to each other, we do a barrel tasting event in the winter. And
is that every winter that you do the barrel tasting?
Yeah, okay. Every winter.
Yeah, right. And that's a club only event.
Four or five other Seacoast wineries participate in this. So you can come up. Mm-hmm. It's actually great. Come stay in the villas and travel to all the other wineries in the area.
I'm there.
Yeah, it's super fun. But we haven't done this every year, but there's been 2 years where we were distilling apple brandy at the same time that this was happening. So we were able to show people, this is what goes into the barrel and this is what comes out. Perfect. And you can see the shock in people's eyes of like, this is how much the barrel changes the spirit.
Yeah.
So we go into a combination of, once it's done being distilled, we cut it down to, I want to say it's 120 proof. It goes into essentially wine cooperage, 60-gallon, 24 to 36-month air-dried cooperage.
What kind of barrel of wood are you using?
It's American oak. Yeah, so it's American oak. I typically don't use French oak here. Mm-hmm. We have played around a little bit with French oak in our Fauche mm-hmm. before, in one of our wines, but mm-hmm. for the most part, it's American oak.
Not charred?
So almost all of our spirits go into charred barrels except our brandies.
Okay.
So our brandies always go into toasted barrels.
Except the apple brandies?
Apple brandy also goes into toasted barrels.
It goes into toasted
barrels. So any brandies that we make here at Fly Kill all go into toasted barrels.
Okay.
So
And I'm going to just ask one more question. One use?
Brand new.
For brand new, one use, then the barrel moves on.
Correct.
Okay.
Well,
I mean, just for the brandy.
For brandy, yeah.
You're
for
just
apple
using
brandy.
One use there. You might use the barrels for something else in your production here. But
for Josiah brandy, Bartlett apple brandy, yes, brand new barrel every mm-hmm. year. We bring in brand new barrels to fill for our, and we actually mm-hmm. just got the shipment in like 2 days ago of our brandy barrels. Because there's a shortage of barrels. A lot of people don't think know this. So we got way ahead of it this year.
Good. That's a relief, I'm sure.
Yeah, very much. So the apple brandy is aged, a combination of 24 to 36-month air-dried staves. This is important for people who don't know much about barrels. Air-dried staves are very, very important for flavor development, specifically because what we're doing is we're allowing mycelium to grow, mushrooms to grow throughout the oak over the course of that 24 to 36 months. Because that's what breaks down. There's fungus among us, right? It breaks everything down. So it seems, let's do the same thing to the wood once the antifungal properties of the live oak tree go away. So it starts to create these like little, very tiny micropores throughout the, like these little pathways, little highways mm-hmm. throughout the oak. And then when we toast the inside of the barrel, we kill off the mycelium, and then what's left is these little passageways for transportation of oxygen. In the wine world, oxygen is our enemy. If I could make wine in a positive pressure room and we all had to wear oxygen masks and walk around with oxygen being pumped into our masks from outside, that's how we would make wine. That's unrealistic. That's not what we do. Mm-hmm. But that's how we make wine if we could. And spirits is the opposite. I actually want a little bit of oxygen. I don't want too much oxygen, right. But a little bit of oxygen mm-hmm. Is very important. So these 24 to 36 month air-dried staves allow for better transportation of these small amounts of oxygen over time. So as the spirit evaporates out of the barrel, what we know is the angel share, we're doing two things. Thing one, we're concentrating the flavors and the spirit and the flavors that we pulled out of the oak, mm-hmm. the caramelized wood sugars and all the goodies that are inside the oak barrel, the actual physical material that's been pulled out of the oak. And the second thing that we're doing is after we evaporate some of that spirit out, is there's no vacuums naturally on Earth, right? So we're transporting atmosphere from outside of the barrel into the inside of the barrel. Mm-hmm. And on the inside of the barrel, now we have a little bit of atmosphere, which is 21% oxygen. And 21% of that oxygen is, and some of that oxygen is being used to turn organic acids or the simplest way to think about this, I guess, is organic acid plus ethyl in the presence of oxygen over time equals esters. So if you use that basic, very simple formula, we wind up with being able to make really, really pretty aromatics in our brandy without having to keep the solventy aromas that are sometimes found in other styles of apple brandy. Mm-hmm. And I'm really, really happy with what comes out of it.
Nice.
Shall we try some?
Yeah,
let's go.
Definitely.
Let's go
while
into
we're clanking,
it.
I'm gonna go grab the.
Yeah.
Oh, sounds good.
Hey, cheers.
Cheers. Cheers. So, notice the weight on the tongue. How there's like a heaviness. That is because we're distilling deeper. And again, so like an untrained distiller, and I was very lucky that I got to learn from somebody who knows this and been doing it for a long time. And
this is delicious. I just want to say straight up, this is delicious. Damn, yeah, like really.
Thankfully, it's not 95 degrees.
Yeah, I know.
It's not 95 degrees.
This warms you up on the inside.
It's good.
It does, but like it's just so smooth, and you're getting so much complexity there. You're saying weight on the tongue, but. And I mean, like the whole mouthfeel, and it's almost like kind of buttery.
Yeah, it's buttery.
You know, yep. On it, really. But
yeah, so the
in a nice way, kind of buttery.
Yeah,
that's exactly what you want it.
Apples have a high amount of malic acid, mm-hmm. so you can coax out a compound mm-hmm. called diacetyl when you ferment them, and that is one of that like the buttery characteristic we're getting there, mm-hmm. In a nice way. It's not like negative diacetyl because diacetyl can be really aggressive and bad in spirit.
Not greasy.
Not greasy.
Just.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, lovely, really smooth.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And it's again, you see what I mean by like the solventy characteristics mm-hmm. that a lot of brandies have. This
yeah,
doesn't have those.
Yeah.
There's the apple aromas are still there. They're gentle. Mm-hmm. They're subtle and soft. There's mm-hmm. not. They're not like some apple brandies you'll put your nose into, and it is just like biting into an apple, right? Like that mm-hmm. that aroma that you get. Mm-hmm. The first retronasal piece of biting into an apple mm-hmm. that you get. This has, maybe 10%, 20% lighter than kind of the most exciting piece that's ever been made with apple, like that apple rim that I've ever had, of apple brandy that I've ever had. Mm-hmm. But then immediately you just get like a ton of, kind of silky, buttery weight on the tongue. And all this complexity of like other fruit aromas, even like I get some cinnamon, I get like clovey type mm-hmm. aromas and flavors, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All kinds of goodies.
Yeah,
really? I mean, even after you swallow it, there's more. Like there's
yeah,
more stuff.
I know. This is one of those brandies that when the glass is empty, just keep sniffing the glass. Mm-hmm. You know, put it on your dresser. But it's just like yeah, I mean the nose is just beautiful.
And it does benefit a little bit. If you pour a glass and let it sit for about 5 minutes, it mm-hmm. does benefit from that. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So just for listeners who aren't here and able to see this, what would you say that color is there? It's very kind of like a light golden straw bit as I'm getting.
Just you had prettier words. I don't have a pretty word for it.
Well, it's lovely, yeah.
Definitely straw.
Yeah.
It's light.
Gold,
it's
like a, very gold.
It's light
golden,
in part.
Yeah.
It's lighter in color, and part yeah. of that is because it's a toasted barrel,
yeah.
not a
charred
barrel.
Right.
But even 11 years.
I mean, yeah, even 11 years is still, I mean,
yeah.
you see how light that is.
Yeah.
In a brand new barrel.
Yeah.
You know.
Are you toasting your barrels here yourself?
No.
No, okay.
We buy them
it sounded like you were. I just wanted to make sure that.
No, we buy
okay,
them
okay, they're all pre-toasted. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I get on the nose in a big way is butterscotch.
Yeah.
I get a lot of butterscotch. It almost tastes like I smell like a Werther's original type candy. Mm.
They have different flavors for Werther's. Yeah, the original would be the one.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's funny. I was I'm smelling it, and it's funny the weird places your mind goes and the like the specificity. And to me, it's like it's almost like cold apple pie.
Mm-hmm.
Like when apple pie is warm, mm. you get so much more of a sweetness to it.
Mm, that's
and this is like it's like the hint of the apple, but with like the spice. Along
yeah,
with
the
it.
Spice, like the clove and the nutmeg.
Yeah, mm-hmm. reheated it up.
Mm-hmm. We're really proud of it. So.
Yeah, you should be.
And our brandy is named after Josiah Bartlett, and he is one of the revolutionary fathers of the country. He was a doctor. And he was selected to be in the Continental Congress that just happened to go down and sign a document called the Declaration of Independence, declaring our independence from the British Empire. And then after that, he served on as a New Hampshire Supreme Court justice. And when the Constitution was signed, he was one of the proponents to ratify it. And after that, became the first governor of New Hampshire, at least in the form that it was when Constitution had been ratified and the United States became the United States and not just independent colonies in the Articles of Confederation. So he's kind of befitting. He died in Kingston, which is just a few minutes down the road, basically.
So David is many things, and I didn't know he was a historian, but I just found that out.
Well, it is a cool story. This guy, Josiah Bartlett, you know, it's like, I love that. It's, you know, kind of like an apple.
Yeah. Right? So his name is familiar for a lot of reasons from history. For those of you who are fans of The West Wing, president in The West Wing is Josiah Bartlett, and he's named and supposed to be a relative of Josiah Bartlett. And he, of course, in the show, not in real life, was the governor of New Hampshire before he became the president in The West Wing. So when I first saw that product, I thought they named it after the guy from West Wing.
I thought that too, but I looked it up.
That's funny.
Be cool. I mean, what a popular show. Yeah. And it's nice. You're kind of like, you have a certain rhythm that you're doing in the labeling, and you're really celebrating New England and specifically New Hampshire. Your ability to like speak clearly and bring that into like metaphors and help both professional makers, producers, and the novice or just aficionados is really spot on.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
It really is.
It's kind of
done. Yeah. It shows your passion and also shows your ability to explain that. That's a skill that not a lot of people have, to put that into simple terms.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you. I love what we do. We are very, very lucky. Very, very lucky people. It's something we talk about a lot. So we get to come here every day, make fun wines, fun spirits. Like, there's way worse things. Our lives are awesome.
I know that if you listen this far that you enjoy this conversation with both Brian Ferguson and David Breslin. Brian is the master distiller and owner of Flag Hill Winery and Distillery. And David, he is kind of known as the company's wingman. He's like everywhere, is a historian and a really nice chap. It was so nice to have this sit-down talk with them. And you, dear Ciderville, can have a taste of Josiah Bartlett Apple Brandy by coming to Saturday's 2.0 and attending the Calvados and American Apple Brandy Tasting. Check out the tickets for that event at ciderchat.com. Just click the link for Saturday's 2.0. And if you're in the region, who wouldn't want to go to their barrel tasting event each winter? It's open to the public. There are also other seacoast wineries involved. So New Hampshire's got it going on. I feel really lucky that I'm a New Englander and I'm so close to these exotic places that really deliver local products made with quality at the forefront and sustainability. That's what it's all about. And luckily, I know that you too have that in your own special spot of Ciderville. And with that, I leave you here. This is Real Wind Caller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
We like cider. We like palms. We love orchards and having fun. There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh, yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh, yes, there is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider. We like palms. We like orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason. There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes, we do.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We love orchards, having some fun. There is a reason. There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There's a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
Ba-da-da-dum. We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
Yeehaw!